CFRU is looking for new shows. We want you to make media here. We are especially looking for arts, news, and political content. We want to make media that is current, edgy, and unlike anything else heard in Guelph. We want to make media that is social justice savvy, community-minded, and represents the richness of our communities. We want to make media that is inclusive of First Nations people, queer and trans folk, communities of color, seniors, folks of all abilities, women, girls, and youth. No previous experience necessary and training is provided. Get involved as a tech, host, producer, researcher, or one of 1,000 other things. Yes, you. Contact programming at cfru.ca.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CFRU Radio in Guelph, Ontario. I'm your host, Kimberly Lamb.
Obviously, one of the main concerns is that Canada continues to export asbestos to third world nations.
Coming from the SFSS directors and board, they currently have kept their staff locked out for 12 weeks.
We've known that it's beneficial. It reduces the transmission of HIV.
In this edition, folks in Sarnia speak out against Canadian asbestos exports. Students at Simon Fraser University occupy offices in response to an ongoing lockout and reactions to the Supreme Court's decision on Vancouver's safe injection site. But first, here are the headlines.
Pregnant women in Western Labrador are currently having to travel to Newfoundland to give birth because there are no doctors in Labrador City performing deliveries. While most travel costs are being covered by the province, this does not reduce the stress or inconvenience of not being able to give birth at home. It also creates more obstacles for women with low incomes, for single mothers who have to arrange care for their other children, and for women who, for a variety of reasons, already face barriers in accessing health care.
That was Sam Kriviak from CJSR in Edmonton.
A vendor in a London, Ontario farmer's market was told to leave for employing a transgendered woman. Karen Clark owns the True to You stall that sold candles and incense at Trails End Market and other venues around London. She had employed Danny Dominic, a transgendered woman, and had never encountered any issues, until one day in September when she asked Danny to take care of the booth.
I asked Danny to come in around noon and relieve me so I could get home and get some stuff prepped. Danny did just that, brought a couple of friends who were transgender, and apparently that was just something that was unacceptable to the management at Trails End. They phoned me at 5 to 8 on Saturday night and said I should know why they were calling, and I hadn't a clue. And they essentially told me that if I was going to have those individuals working at my booth, that I was invited to take my booth elsewhere.
Clark removed her booth and has filed a human rights complaint against the Trails End Market. We talked to Danny Dominic, the woman at the heart of the controversy.
I moved from Windsor because of the discrimination and the heartaches and everything else to London, and I've always felt safe in London, and now this, it kind of pushed me right back into my shell. I mean, I'm just as much human as anybody else on the face of this earth. Everybody has a right to make a living. It doesn't matter who I am, my sexuality, what I look like. I mean, this is who I am. I mean, it doesn't affect other businesses, so people need to be educated.
Trails End, this weekend, was given a petition of over 4,000 signatures asking them to stop discriminating against trans people. The manager of the market, Ed Kirkert, responded by saying he was only interested in one signature on his own petition, that of Jesus Christ. For Groundwire, I'm Ed von Edderkass from CHOW Radio.
The mayor of Toronto is seeking a disciplinary hearing for a doctor who has been helping people on welfare have healthier diets. Here is Nikki Bozanoff interviewing physician and anti-poverty advocate Dr. Roland Wong. The hearing is scheduled to take place from October 17th to the 21st.
On July 1st of this year, many people in Ontario found themselves
no longer eligible for the special diet allowance, or a sum of money that could effectively be prescribed by a doctor for specific medical conditions requiring dietary modifications. Cuts to the program under Dalton McGuinty apparently came as the cost to the program increased from $5 million in 2003 to $6 million in 2009. But poverty advocates across the province say that increases in the cost of the program reflect the fact the recipients, many of them receiving social assistance, began asking their healthcare providers to complete their special diet forms, and does not, as some politicians have alluded, reflect an abuse of the program. Many healthcare providers across the province filled out these forms willingly, but one in particular is being singled out and faces disciplinary hearing in front of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. Physician and anti-poverty advocate Dr. Wong.
They're accusing me of signing forms mm-hmm. without checking exactly what mm-hmm. these people have.
So essentially they're saying, like, you should have been more...
Doing more tests.
Right, you should have been doing more tests. You should have been more suspicious yes. of what these people were telling you.
Yes. But the issue in medical science, of course, is that we have to be cost-conscious, too. Mm-hmm. We can order tests for everything, but mm-hmm. to what reason? Am I going to treat them? No, I'm not, for most of them anyway, the majority of them.
Mm-hmm.
And is it cost-effective? No, it's not.
And what's the worst-case scenario here?
Worst-case scenario is they can suspend your license.
Mm-hmm.
They can suspend your license permanently. They can mm-hmm. suspend it for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
They can just give you a reprimand. They can just say it's goodbye to you. We have nothing to do with you now. That's how the range from severity.
Should you not have your license revoked, presumably you'll still be able to fill out those forms.
I still fill some forms for some of my patients that I see for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because to not fill the forms is actually a disservice
mm-hmm.
To me, it's almost like crime. Mm-hmm. It's medical malpractice not
mm-hmm.
to help them.
Mm-hmm.
On the 26th of September, Londoners and community members of all ages marched through the streets of downtown London to protest the police tasering of a high school student. The incident took place on September 23rd when a police officer broke up a fight between two teenagers by tasering one of them in the face. Someone in the crowd caught the action on video, which would later go viral on YouTube. CHRW's Mike Roy caught up with the mother of the tasered youth. Under the Youth Offenders Act, we cannot give her name. She said her son was suffering, but was lucky to have survived being tasered in the face.
They said, the plastic surgeon said, if it was like 2 centimeters over, he'd be permanently paralyzed in the face. Yeah. And the one in his chest, that day, he had 3 t-shirts on. And I think that's what saved his life. Because a lot of people die from that, especially young people. And I think the 3 t-shirts buffered the taser that was in his chest because it was right above his heart. So.
Yeah. What kind of justice do you think you'll get in the end?
In a perfect world, this guy would lose his job. Officers would get proper training. Tasering would be a complete, utter last resort. And they wouldn't do that on kids, you know. But in reality, have the police ever admitted to any wrongdoings? Never. Never.
For Groundwire, I'm Ed Von Ettercast from CHRW, London.
Peace and love! Peace and love!
Those are the Groundwire headlines. We'll be back after a short music break.
Since aching at dawn.
Was Old Friend by local Guelph musician Lion Detective Club. And now here are the feature stories on Groundwire Community Radio News. In Sarnia, Ontario, hundreds rallied to speak out against Canadian asbestos exports. The event remembered the victims of asbestos exposure in Sarnia's Chemical Valley and around the world.
Could you tell us who you are?
My name is Leah Nielsen.
My name is Stacey Catron.
And could you tell us about the event today?
Yeah, we had a walk to remember the victims of asbestos, and we had a phenomenal turnout in Sarnia. Crowd estimates were 500 to 700 people, and it was a blustery cold day.
We had speeches from the mayor, the head of OCOW, which is for occupational workers. We had Linda Reinstein fly in from California. She's the president and co-founder of Asbestos Disease Awareness Organization. And they talked about how Canada is exporting asbestos to the developing world, especially places like India, where the workers are unprotected. And years from now, develop mesothelioma and actually are already developing it from working with it.
I think the most special speaker that we had was Bruce Bradshaw, and he was actually a co-worker of my dad's many years ago at Dow Chemical, and he actually has mesothelioma right now. He got a standing ovation today as he described kind of what he's going through, and Prime Minister Harper, he wished he could stand eye-to-eye and toe-to-toe with him and do Rick Mercer's rant to him about asbestos. It was very touching.
So you two basically got this event together. You got it rolling, as how I understand it.
Yeah, actually, it was my sister who called me in May and said it's time to do a walk in remembrance of Dad. The political climate is just right.
We lost our dad 3.5 years ago to mesothelioma, and we were furious that Prime Minister Harper was campaigning in Asbestos Quebec and standing beside the asbestos industry saying that they would support them no matter what, and then blocked the Rotterdam Convention, which would put a labeling asbestos as a hazardous material.
And I think the straw that broke the camel's back was Harper campaigning in Asbestos Quebec. That's what really got us.
So what were your goals in working on this event?
I think
banning asbestos.
Yeah, the ultimate goal is to ban asbestos, but I think a secondary goal is just to educate people, because people just don't have any idea what the Canadian government is doing. And to be honest, I didn't know until my dad was diagnosed with mesothelioma, but we've spent the last 3.5 years researching more about this fibrous mineral that prematurely took the life of our father.
My name is Zach Nichols. I'm a resident of Sarnia, and you could say I'm an activist for human rights issues around the Chemical Valley here in Sarnia-Lambton. And about the rally today about asbestos, could you tell us what the significance of that was from your point of view as someone who's lived here for a long time?
I think one thing about the rally today that was really important was it brought out so many people from the community. A lot of the people who are there today are people who have lost someone due to asbestos-related illness or who are currently dealing with an illness. One of the speakers today is someone who is dying from mesothelioma, and so he had a really important message. And myself, personally, I've never lost someone that I can conclusively say died due to asbestos-related illness, but I never met my grandfather. He worked at General Electric in Peterborough, and he worked with asbestos, but we couldn't find enough years that he worked directly with the asbestos to make a proper claim. It's not to say that he wasn't exposed to it long enough, it's just we couldn't prove it. So that's somewhat significant, because there is a saying around Sarnia-Lambton that there are a generation of children who have grown up never knowing their grandfathers because there has been so much illness related to asbestos. And not only are they missing their grandfathers, obviously, families are missing their husbands, their fathers, And also we have a lot of these men were union leaders. They were civic leaders. And so the community has lost out too with their illness. The significance of today's event was that it brought people from all over North America to get together and to recognize just how serious this asbestos issue is. Obviously, one of the main concerns is that Canada continues to export asbestos to third world nations, despite knowing exactly how harmful it is and knowing that there is no safe handling of asbestos. The government will say that there are safe practices, but there aren't. And the people who are handling it in the third world nations don't have the equipment they need. So another thing, too, is that today's event seemed to also bring out members of the community who haven't necessarily lost someone, but who are just concerned and who can see how significant the issue is, and that was really important. Sarnia is probably the hardest hit city in Canada, certainly in Ontario, for asbestos-related illness. One thing that is interesting is that we are federally a conservative riding, and our member of parliament has been largely quiet about the issue. She didn't attend the demonstration today. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but she's been largely silent. And, you know, that brings a lot of frustration from people here who feel that they're not only being ignored by Ottawa, but they're also now being ignored by their local member.
Tobin Black of the Media Co-op brought us that report from Sarnia.
This is Nina Halliday reporting to you from Burnaby Mountain on Simon Fraser University campus, which is in the Metro Vancouver, Canada area. On September 27th, a sit-in occurred on the mountain. Students of all stripes occupied the common area of the Simon Fraser Student Society, also known as SFSS. As of July 11th, during the summer semester, the Student Society Board of Directors took decisive action by locking out student support staff. These employees that are part of a meta-union called Canadian Union of Public Employees, also known as QP, which has two branches at SFU. It is a small branch that is affected. There remain 13 employees, 12 full-time, and one student position that are not on strike, but to this day remain locked out of their offices. The student services affected are the Copy Center out on campus, Women's Center, the resource offices both on the Mountain and Surrey campus. The other two downtown campuses are not affected. Part of the challenge with this labor dispute is that it is complex. Following, there are clips of conversations, both calm and heated, that were recorded near the end of the sit-in. Due to the sensitivity of this ongoing dispute, the voices remain anonymous.
So what's going on?
Well, I'll briefly let you know that this is a sit-in that's been staged by students who are concerned because of the lack of representation that we feel is coming from the SFSS directors and board. They currently have kept their staff locked out for 12 weeks, and so we are matching their 12 weeks with 12 hours sitting inside their offices, which are technically our student space, since we are SFSS members.
How do you feel about the SFSS lockout at this time?
Well, I don't feel very good about it. It seems to take a lot of the spirit away from the university. It just strikes me as something very uncaring, unfeeling, and very corporate about it. And it's just the old feeling of what a university is all about, people coming here, expanding their knowledge. And it's taking away essential services that are really important to students. Sort of the students that are on the outside, the fringe, the people that really need help and support.
Anyone who crosses a picket line is unprincipled. Especially a picket line around a women's center. And who needs to run a women's center? The people who need to run a women's center are women who are sensitive to feminist issues and who understand gender politics.
And are highly, highly trained.
And I completely agree with you.
And are those people running it now?
Or they're not in there right now.
No, they're not running it now, so the center doesn't exist. No, the center doesn't exist. The service doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist because what
makes it is the feminist politics that are the backbone of it. Without that, the center doesn't exist. The same as the out-on-campus center. It doesn't exist if there aren't people who understand lesbian, gay, transgendered, intersex, queer, two-spirited politics. People don't understand those things, and the center does not exist.
You know, the center doesn't exist if it's falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. The center doesn't exist if we cannot buy new materials to fill it.
If we continue
the center
doesn't exist.
So you should raise the stipends for board of directors.
If we continue on this path,
continue on
if
which
we continue
of raising
on
the stipends
the path of bankruptcy, path to bankruptcy, there will be no women's center or out on campus.
Bankruptcy? What are we talking about? Bankruptcy? Is the university not going to exist because of students?
It's
SFSS space.
The
what? Not the university, it's the student society.
That's our space.
You're saying the student society will not exist if we do not pay our student fees. Is that right?
That's not what I said.
No, but I'm saying that would happen, right? If I didn't pay my...
The Supreme Court of Canada has saved North America's only safe injection site for drug users in Vancouver's Lower East Side. The court ruled that InSight's overwhelming benefit to the community means the government must allow it to continue operating. Does this open the door for further safe injection sites across Canada? Trevor Chow Fraser from CFRU Radio asks that question.
On September 30th, the Supreme Court ruled that InSight must be given a permanent exemption to Canada's drug laws.
So my name is Anna Marie D'Angelo at Vancouver Coastal Health. Oh, sure, we're extremely pleased that the Supreme Court of Canada has supported what we're doing at InSight. We've known that it's beneficial. It reduces the transmission of HIV, hepatitis C. It connects these clients to care.
Vancouver Coastal Health isn't the only one satisfied with the ruling. Across the country, advocates for better drug and public health policies are smiling. They see it as a crucial tool for organizations practicing harm reduction.
Ultimately, in a perfect world, people would not use illicit drugs, but that's not the world that we live in. So it behooves us as a society to take a pragmatic approach to drug use and to come up with strategies around that.
That's Patricia Bacon from Blood Ties, a community organization in the northern town of Whitehorse. She believes that harm reduction is the best strategy for dealing with the realities of drug use. Initiatives like a needle exchange reduce the risk of drug overdose and of contracting deadly diseases like HIV or hepatitis C. Benefits include stabilizing drug use so it's more controllable, people are healthier, more able to continue working, having families, while dealing with addiction. So does Blood Ties intend to open a supervised injection site in the Yukon?
You know, the InSight decision definitely is going to open some doors. And there are definitely other communities in Canada where a safe injection site is definitely needed. However, harm reduction approaches can take on many forms, and there's many different ways of doing harm reduction. And not all of the tools in the harm reduction toolkit are needed for every community. So, for example, while a safe injection site makes very good sense for the downtown east side because of the nature of the way the drug injecting population works down there, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense everywhere, and it doesn't particularly at this time make sense for a community such as Whitehorse. So while it might open doors for communities that definitely need that, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have safe injection sites all over the country everywhere there happens to be a needle exchange at this time, because for a lot of other places, a safe injection site is not what's needed. Like, I mean, there's some communities that are still struggling to have their needle exchange. There's some communities that are still struggling to have a safer crack kit program, those kinds of things. And for some smaller communities, those are the things that are what's needed right now.
But for a town like Whitehorse, the decision might not matter at all. When I spoke with Vancouver Coastal Health, Anna Marie clarified the scope of the InSight ruling.
The decision is specifically about InSight, in that the Supreme Court judges said that the minister has discretion to allow this exemption for the drug laws, but because InSight obviously has health benefits and it caused no harm in the community, there was no increased crime or anything like that associated, then the minister should grant that exemption. But it was very clear to say that that was not the case for everywhere.
But Ed Jackson from Toronto-based Katie thinks the door has been opened, if only a little.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be so easy. I think they'll have to, anyone who's doing it, and there are certainly our cities that have been thinking about it and waiting to see whether there will be some support for safer injection services. They will have to make a very strong case and then request exemption from the minister. But I think the decision doesn't give the minister as much latitude, you know, that it can't be arbitrary.
It seems likely, then, that supervised injection sites could soon become a hot issue in a community near you.
So why people are opposed, get so excited about it, I honestly don't know. I think in B.C. and in the downtown east side area, people actually understand that it's a good thing, and people aren't opposed to it. It just seems to be the further away they are from it, the less they understand. Also, I think in a moral attitude about drugs that, without a clear understanding of addictions, that just simply saying, "I'll stop now," is not often possible for people, especially when they're living marginalized and kind of chaotic lives.
For Groundwire, I'm Trevor Chow Fraser at CFRU News.
Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Community radio stations across the country are upgrading their facilities to become more accessible to users living with disability. The transformations are enabling people with vision and mobility challenges to gain full access to the airwaves.
My name is Kevin Shaw. I'm the technical production coordinator here at CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto. We had a renovation done about 5 years ago to our offices here at CHRY.
The renovations included layout changes to the office and studios, including door width and floor surfaces. The door width allows for egress of wheelchair and mobility aids and different flooring patterns so that people with vision impairments are able to get around more easily.
I think the biggest thing for me would be just making sure that aside from the actual space, that a lot of the equipment and the processes also remain accessible to people. So that includes things like having documentation in electronic format and, possibly having, some additional kind of tactile signs and stuff around the station for somebody with vision loss.
Susan Wheeler is the host of a show on accessibility on CFRU. Susan's station would like to see similar changes in technology and infrastructure this year.
My name is Susan Wheeler, and I'm the host of Accessibility Matters here at CFRU.
We asked Susan about how the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act was affecting stations, including hers.
The AODA has been the impetus to create some conversation around the lack of accessibility that is still present in, what places we would think would have that in place.
But it's not that easy. Every community radio station has its own unique challenges.
I led a session on accessibility at the NCRC, and some stations are kind of handcuffed by the fact that they're in universities that are a lot older and have older infrastructure, so they don't necessarily have the resources or the ability to, put in, let's say, a chairlift or an elevator or something that would allow somebody who's got a mobility impairment to use their facility. A lot of the places are, in the basement of buildings that are only accessible by stairs. So that becomes a challenge. And it's going to require some creative problem solving on their parts to, working with the universities, have some way of solving these problems. So it's easier for some stations rather than others.
The challenge at Susan's station is funding, so their annual funding drive this year will focus on making their space as accessible as possible. This could include purchasing assistive technology or interior aids like an automatic door opener or hydraulic table.
CFRU is kind of really presenting a really good example to follow whether somebody is another station has accessibility or not, because it's an initiative that is including all voices. And, I love the name Raise Your Voice as their annual fund ride name. So I think that the AODA has influenced a lot of people, a lot of businesses, public and private. I don't think CFRU was pushed into this or anything. I think they were just really right on board with it.